So increasingly, behavioral health is becoming recognized as a national and local priority area. In Chicago, there's a demand for quality data on the current status of behavioral health services, and it is the role of the health department to understand what services exist and where the gaps might be. This project is aiming to describe, evaluate, and quantify the capacity of the current system. Currently, CDPH is also working with several community partners on developing a centralized referral and resource directory for the city. This assessment will provide some data for that project. In 2006, a similar assessment was conducted, but was smaller in scope. It only looked at mental health services, whereas we have expanded the assessment to include substance abuse and violence prevention services. While the added domains increase the length of the survey and the general complexity of the project, we hope it will also give a more detailed and complete picture of behavioral health services in Chicago. We broke up the assessment in 7 phases listed here, and I'm going to be focusing on our process, which encompasses the first 3 phases. We are currently in phase 4 and 5, as we have sent out the survey and are in the process of following up with agencies who have not yet filled it out. The first phase was to conceptualize the assessment, determine the methods, and define the scope. The main question was, what do we mean by capacity, as there are many different ways to define it, and how do we measure it? We wanted to ensure that we consulted with stakeholders outside of CDPH throughout this process to ensure that the assessment is relevant and useful to the community. We reached out to individuals at community organizations and academic institutions to discuss the project and the proposed methods. We also did research into similar assessments that have been conducted in other cities, and we were able to speak with individuals who worked on those and get their insight and access their surveys. Overall, these conversations and research confirmed the need for this type of assessment in Chicago and supported the proposed methods of sending out a survey and conducting focus groups. The data collection has 2 components, a qualitative component consisting of focus groups with providers and a quantitative component consisting of surveys to agencies. When developing the data collection instruments, we also consulted with stakeholders and researched existing surveys. Our survey content was drawn heavily from existing SAMHSA surveys, but tailored to Chicago specifically. We had to consider several things when developing the survey, including, was it going to be one for each agency or one for each facility within the agency? We ultimately decided on a shorter survey for the agency overall and a longer survey for each facility. We also had to decide, would we have one survey for each domain, mental health, substance abuse, and violence prevention, or one survey overall? We decided to include all domains in one survey, but have skip patterns that would allow the agency to skip over the irrelevant sections. The questions in the survey asked about specific services provided, facility information such as hours of operation, staff employed, waitlist times, languages spoken, and consumer demographics. We decided to use Qualtrics to distribute the survey because it's extremely user-friendly, allows the participant to save their work and come back, and is easily downloadable at the end. Lastly, we piloted these tools internally at CDPH as well as externally with community agencies. Because this capacity assessment is not a sample of agencies, but rather more of a census, including all relevant agencies was incredibly important. We spent a lot of time compiling our list of participant agencies, about 350 in total. We drew agencies from many different sources. Determining who to send the survey to was an important step. We decided to contact each agency, describe the survey, and ask for the contact information of the best person to send it to. When we sent the survey out, we sent it to that person as well as the executive director of the agency. We included all agencies specializing in providing direct behavioral health services, but excluded individual and group private practices. All this is to say, we learned a lot throughout the process. One is to constantly be flexible as things come up and change, understanding that things will take a lot longer than anticipated and building that into the project timeline. Thinking carefully about the scope of the project, we decided to look at 3 domains of behavioral health, which really added length to the survey, number of participant agencies, and time to contact and distribute the survey. However, like I said, it will give us a more rich understanding of services available. Using the best web platform was very important for us. We had originally used a more complicated and less user-friendly platform, but after piloting it, we realized it would not work and would impact our response rate. Switching to Qualtrics alleviated many of these problems. Lastly, involving community stakeholders was very important, both to ensuring that the survey questions were comprehensive, relevant, and accurate, but also to get buy-in and support for the project. Sorry. So I'd like to acknowledge my coworkers that worked on this. And thank you.
Okay, great. This session is now open for questions. So if anyone with questions can make their way to the microphone. And if you could just join me in thanking this amazingly diverse variety of topics and great job by all the speakers. So any questions given? Wow. Well, why don't, oh, we have one, yeah, coming up. And just if you could say which talk it was for.
Yeah, this is about the support plan in Boulder for Ebola virus disease. So you talked about it and you said that you are kind of continuing to use this system for other emerging infectious diseases, it sounds like. And I am wondering if you can talk a little bit about how this is supported economically and just kind of in the larger context and what the capacity is, how that's changed from Ebola to other infectious diseases.
And why don't you come up here and use the microphone.
Thank you so much for that question, and thank you everyone for listening and staying here today. So to answer your question, we have looked at using our Ebola support plan for other diseases. So we've looked at it specifically for measles because we're in Boulder County and we have a low vaccination rate. So measles was one area that we think would probably be much more likely than us ever having the Ebola case. We did have in El Paso, there was a measles case and they did not have a support plan. And so they contacted us to talk about how they could implement it for, in their setting. So when we talked to them, we had determined for each disease it would be different. So as I mentioned, the eligibility would be different for each disease. The scope for measles, for instance, would be only for people that it would not be available for people that were refusing the vaccine. It would be for people that couldn't have it for a medical reason, for instance. And so, that was one way to address the scope. In terms of how it would be funded, we're going to reach out to our county commissioners, but currently we have in place relationships with mental health partners, Housing and Human Services, and they agreed to take on those financial responsibilities. So we did actually have relationships in place through our emergency management folk, and they agreed to take on the financial responsibility. In terms of the workplace, financial reimbursement, that was a little bit different because we were going to first advocate for the person having working from home options, and we probably wouldn't provide actual financial compensation, but we would do it in the format of maybe paying for the rent or paying for them. And there, our public health director allowed us to release emergency funds for that purpose. Thank you for the question.
I had a question about the presentation on Heliobacter in Alaska Natives. So I noticed that you merged two data sets together to get your complete hospitalization data. One was from ANTHC, I believe, or from the Alaska Native Health, and then also the statewide data set. So I was wondering if you could talk about, did you notice any differences between those data sets in terms of the outcomes or the quality of race information, especially for the state?
Thank you. It's a great question. I'm not sure if I'm going to be best placed to answer it. We merged both of the data sets as a collaboration, and there was a deduplication of areas which were included in both of the hospitalization data sets. I think it's fair to say there's more experience using the Indian Health Service data set, and we've worked with Indian Health Service closely for many years with that. The combined data excludes, as I mentioned, sort of one hospital and then military hospitals in Alaska. But it's one of the issues that, for the purpose of this analysis, sort of one of these things in epidemiology where you can have pretty messy data and then just focus on parts of the data that you trust well. And so we were confident that we could trust the ICD-9 coding and the basic age, sex, and race data. And so that was the basis for our analysis.
First of all, let me say thank you to all the presenters. That was an amazing job. I'm sure you were asked to compress years' worth of work into 5 minutes of presentation. No small feat, so I think you all did a great job. My question is for the last speaker from the Chicago Department of Health. You mentioned that you excluded private practitioners and group practitioners from your data collection, and I'm curious to understand why you did that, because my experience is they do provide a significant amount of the behavioral health care, so I'm thinking that might have impacted the overall picture of your results.
So we decided to exclude private practices because we felt like it would be very hard to ensure that we got all of them and to have a complete picture. One way we were going to kind of compensate for that was to look at licensure data. So to say there are this many licensed social workers in Chicago, this many licensed psychiatrists, to try and supplement that. And we also excluded them sort of following how SAMHSA does it in their survey of mental health facilities, as in they also exclude small private practices. So that was kind of why we did that.
Hello. This question is directed to the Oregon County representative who gave a Casper presentation. I found it very curious that you mentioned that the method worked best for urban areas over rural areas, and you showed one rural cluster that was located in a rural area that seemed to have difficulty. Could you comment on that and how that might apply to an unbiased sample, which is the ultimate aim of a cluster design?
Sure. So we still followed the two-stage methodology. So the initial population-based sampling, the initial 30 clusters, was done by population size as dictated by the CDC methodology. The part that we didn't do is what you're supposed to do is send out the volunteers to a block and then have them walk it, count every single address or house in there, whether it's 600 apartments or houses or whatever, and then go to every ninth house. When we have 40 square mile blocks, that's not feasible to send out volunteers into a rural area to do. That's just not even reasonable. So what we did, if those blocks were selected, we still chose them. We just had all the EPIs do the work ahead of time. We created route maps. We verified that the addresses weren't no trespassing. We mapped out all the replacement strategies. So we didn't substitute or replace any blocks that weren't naturally selected. We kept them all. It was just we had to do all the work on the front end to help ensure success.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you to everyone that presented today. My question is for the gentleman at New Mexico Department of Health that did the drug overdose deaths among American Indians. When I was looking at your descriptive statistics, I was interested in knowing for New Mexico you had American Indians at 14.1, whites at 25.4, and Hispanics at 26.1. Can you tell me how did you distinguish between multiple race for American Indians and Hispanics? Did you include if someone was multiple race in the Hispanic group, or did you include them in the American Indian group?
Right. We have a structure on how to assign race ethnicity. Whenever they answer to the question whether they are Hispanic, we immediately assign them as race ethnicity Hispanic. So if it would say Hispanic ethnicity, race Native American or African or white, it would be on Hispanic. So only for those who are not of Hispanic ethnicity, a Native American race would be on the Native American race.
So if someone said that they were American Indian and Hispanic, they would go in the Hispanic group or in the American
Indian
group?
On Hispanic. So at the beginning, we also created a binary variable for Hispanic and ran race ethnicity apart, and we got the same trends.
When you did the sensitivity
but
analysis.
Given that there's an advice on how to assign race ethnicity and assigning race ethnicity based on that description, Hispanics, independently of the race on Hispanics, we moved to that structure.
Okay, so it didn't make a difference which group you put them in?
Well, there was a variation in the actual number, but the trend was the same.
The trend was the same. Okay. And can you tell me, did you look at 95% confidence intervals around those rates to determine if your rates for American Indians, whites, and Hispanics were actually statistically different?
Yeah, we had that, and we had the p-values. So I didn't present it for kind of...
I'm not interested in the p-value. I'm interested
in the confidence
interval.
We ran the native 95% confidence interval, and there was a statistical significant difference.
Between?
You're talking about the...
Your descriptive statistics.
Right, when you
looked at American Indians, whites, and Hispanics, were those groups statistically significantly different or not?
Yeah, it was. They were. But I cannot tell you.
All three were different.
I think I'm missing. You're talking about the multivariable.
You're talking about the descriptive statistics.
No. Those are the difference between the whites and the Hispanics. That was on the background. That was in the background. That wasn't part of our analysis.
Right, but you can still put confidence intervals around rates.
Yeah, yeah. And they were, or how much different they were, I cannot.
I can email you and follow
but
up.
But they were different.
I can email you and follow
okay.
up.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you.
I just had a quick question for Tori. I'm just curious. I was actually struck by the fact that in Minnesota you try and identify when we in New York City we rule out a BT event and we stop, but you actually try and figure out what it is. And I'm curious why and if you know if others do it. Sorry to ask a question mid-sip.
Thank you. Mostly. Because when we rule out the biologics, we rule out the threat from an epi perspective. But because we're epidemiologists, we want to know what it was so we can actually describe the events. It also helps us if we know, it's our chem folks that actually figure out what the substance was. So it kind of adds a layer of to describe how these events happen. So people are making cookies when they send in their water bill and you get flour in there, it just kind of adds to describing the event from an epi perspective. It doesn't really help us at all from a preparedness standpoint.
Do you know if others do?
I don't know. I think Minnesota is a little bit unique, but I'm not sure. Thank you.
So any other questions for any of our speakers? Okay, so I think we're a minute ahead or two. I want to thank everyone again for, one, keeping on time and for a great range of topics. And a reminder to fill out your session evaluation for all your sessions, not just this one. So thank you and have a good lunch break.